You are listening to the cycling podcast, at the Tour de France in association with RAFA, the fastest closing in the world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with RAFA in 2019 as a partner EF Education First and Canyon Charam. Stage 4, today we're in Nancy.
Where are we, Lionel?
We're on the tram heading into the centre of Nancy.
What are we doing? We're going to the centre of France. I think you've booked us a restaurant tonight.
Yeah, we're going to the Brasserie Excelsior. That's the most famous restaurant in Nancy. It's very typical of what's called l'École de Nancy, or the Nancy School. That's an architectural and design movement from the very beginning of the 20th century. And Nancy is very famous for that, you know. Like you had the dome crystal and lots of furniture, and you go, the Art Nouveau was, well, you've probably heard of it and you've probably seen it. It's like Mucha, you know, this Czech painter. It's full of flowerish, flowery characters, women and stuff. It's kind of very, there's kind of a lot of marquetry and that sort of stuff, and it's typical of Nancy. So that's where we're going, Excelsior. It's kind of a monument, more a monument of architecture and a monument of food, but it's a nice place.
Disappointing. First, we're going to find a bar to record the first part of the podcast, including your tale of the etape, Lionel, which you'll hear next. Francois, the guy just asked us whether we'd be eating in this bar, but you told him very bluntly, no, we're eating in that much nicer restaurant across the square.
Exactly. He didn't get offended at all, because, I mean, this is a brasserie bearing the name of a famous Belgian beer. So we're here for aperitif, to drink beers. And when I told him, well, he asked us if he wanted something to bite. And I said, well, no, not really, because we're eating next door at Excelsior. And, you know, and we want to be hungry when we get there.
So that's but we were both quite perturbed by that, weren't we, Lionel?
I thought, oh, no, we've told him.
What's he going to do to our beer?
Yeah, but it's quite an interesting study in the difference between French and British manners, because if that had been left to me, I would have said, oh, no, maybe we'll have something in a minute.
Wouldn't we?
Yeah,
well,
maybe.
And then when we finished up here, instead of walking directly to the fancy restaurant, we'd have turned
in
the
other
direction.
Sneaked into Lexington.
We'd given ourselves a round block, around the block, we'd have walked to get there, and then sneaked in hoping he didn't spot us.
Well,
that's what would have happened.
Yeah.
No, proud to be rude, you know, that's the French.
There's just directness. There's a directness that... We're working on that, aren't we, Lionel?
We are. Well, this isn't the etiquette podcast, Richard. This is a cycling podcast. So let's recap stage 4 of the Tour de France, shall we? 213.5 kilometres from Reims to Nancy, from Champagne to Quiche-Lorraine in the space of an afternoon. Three riders attack straight away. Johan Afredo and Frédéric Bacquart of 1T Group Gobert and Michael Schaar of CCC. Once again, the peloton was not really in a mood to let them have much of an advantage. They were kept on a tight leash all day. Schaar attacked with 30 kilometres to go. Bacquart managed to react, but Afredo dropped back at that point. Schaar dropped Bacquart on the Côte de Baron, but was caught before the top with about 16 kilometres to go. And then Lilian Calmejan of Total Direct Energy attacked with 11 kilometres to go, and he was out in front on his own for about 5 or 6 kilometres. But the sprinters teams were in no mood to let him have any more leeway. Came to the sprint where, for a moment, it looked like Alexander Kristoff of UAE Team Emirates was going to win, but then Elia Viviani pipped him on the line. Caleb Ewan was third, Peter Sagan fourth, Dylan Groenewegen, recovering from his crash in the opening stage, was fifth, and Groenewegen's teammate Ternissen, the old yellow jersey, was sixth. So Elia Viviani has won his first Tour de France stage, completing the Grand Tour Grand Slam, and it is, of course, the second stage win in a row for De Koenig Quickstep. All the jerseys are still on the same sets of shoulders. Alaphilippe in yellow, Sagan in green, Wellens in the King of the Mountain jersey, and Van Aert in white. Tomorrow's stage is a lumpy one. It goes to Colmar. But the big news today is that we are in the area famous for Quiche-Lorraine, and I spent all afternoon researching the world record for the biggest Quiche-Lorraine ever made, and discovered that a French chef called Alain Marcotullio made the biggest quiche in the world in 1997. It used 1,928 eggs, and it took all day to bake, 18 hours in fact. When I found a video of this, I was really disappointed to find that it wasn't one giant quiche at all. It was lots of small sections of quiche all put together. Swizzle. So it's not actually the biggest in the world, ain't it, after all.
Next time they should try the biggest rum baba in the world, because rum baba is also from Nancy.
Is that right?
Yeah, because it was actually invented at the court of the King of Poland, Stanislas, who ended up being Duke of Lorraine and living in Nancy. And one day when, you know, he had some spare bread, he put a little bit of rum. His cook, not the king, put a little bit of rum on top of it, and that's how rum baba was created.
On our way here, Francois, we also skirted around Metz, and that is the answer to one of the best cycling pub quiz or trivia questions.
Yeah, what's the first? Well, are we asking a question to our listeners?
Well, you gave the answer.
Yeah. Well, the odd thing is, officially, the first foreign town to get the Tour de France, to host the Tour de France, was Brussels. But in fact, in 1907, there was a stage to Metz, and Metz at the time was German. So actually, the first foreign town to host the Tour de France stage was Metz in 1907. There you are.
The fastest closing in a world tour. The home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as a partner EF Education First and Canyon Charam.
Thank you very much to Rafa, our headline sponsor, and you can follow the films behind the scenes with EF Education First at rafa.cc or on the Rafa YouTube channel. They are spending a lot of time with that team at this Tour de France. We're going to see a lot of them, I think, as we get into the hillier stages. So look out for them. They'll be starting soon. As you said, Lionel, first ever Tour de France stage win for Elia Viviani. He's been a little bit out of sorts, hasn't he, since the Giro. Really made a mess of the sprint on day one, was out of position, and his lead-out train was sort of casting their heads around looking for him. He's got in Michael Morkov and Richese, two fantastic lead-out men. And today it went very well for them. Indeed, they really took control, set him up nicely. Christoph was set up nicely as well. Jumbo-Visma may be disappointed. I think Groenewegen was probably the favourite. He seems to be the fastest on paper of all the sprinters here, but maybe suffering from the crash. But also, Wout van Aert was leading that one out. And Groenewegen and Tunisson seemed to lose each other a little bit, and they came across the line kind of together, but hadn't really worked very effectively together.
No, but De Koninck Quickstep got it right, didn't they? And Viviani spring back in his step after a really disappointing Giro where he thought he'd won a stage and then was disqualified. That was very early in the race, and that really seemed to knock his confidence for the whole of the rest of the race. He had a very poor Giro by his standards, considering he won several stages the previous year. And many a talented sprinter has looked destined to kind of get a Tour de France stage and only to find that it's eluded them. So, yeah, I could understand the joy on Viviani's face at the finish. And, well, De Koninck Quickstep are very good at this, aren't they? When they get on a roll, the sort of the winning feeling, it's sort of contagious. It spreads through the team.
It was very interesting what Viviani said after the race at the press conference. He said, he talked about the train he has here, and he really said, you know, he singled out Morkov as a guy in charge. And actually, when Morkov says something, apparently in the last 2Ks, you have to do it. He's kind of the, you know, chef d'orchestre, the director of the train conductor. And the first order he gave was pretty strange. I mean, interesting to see. He asked the yellow jersey holder, he asked Julien Alaphilippe to launch the lead out. And so the first lead out man in the lead out train was Julien Alaphilippe, followed by himself, Morkov, and then Richese and Viviani finishing the job, and it was really, really well executed. And I think if the rest of the bunch were a little bit disappointed, it's because we can tell they don't have because there were not really so many great sprinters and great trains anymore, which is a change on the Tour de France. We see very unpredictable trains, because Caleb Ewan apparently suffers. They're still trying to get it right. with his lead out people, and same with Alexander Kristoff, who actually, as we pointed out before, he started the tour with his lead and with the lead out man Jasper Philipsen. They never ever raced together, so. And he praised Philipsen a lot today, saying it done the job right, and it came close. So, in the future, we know Kristoff is usually good in the third week of the tour. Well, it'll be difficult this time because it's the Alps. But I mean, later in the tour, and that despair, you know, it looks very promising.
Yeah, Philipsen and Kristoff have raced in the same UAE Team Emirates lineup, but they haven't got things going as lead out man and sprinter yet. And for a first full on effort, they've done pretty well today. Again, you know, we don't generally expect Kristoff to be quite that close to victory this early in a Grand Tour. You're right, he's a real diesel of a sprinter, isn't he? And we've seen him win on those kind of long hot stages, end of the second week kind of thing. But you're right, there isn't really anything of that nature this year. Maybe Nîmes, possibly. I don't know. Maybe
you won in Nîmes already. Remember?
Yeah, but I think they do a loop into the hills, yeah, don't they? So possibly not. But relatively few sprint opportunities. So we haven't even mentioned Peter Sagan, have we? And he does not look like the Peter Sagan of old. I mean, we're kind of used to talking about when will Sagan get a stage win. He went through a tour and a half without a victory at one point, didn't he?
He's always there, isn't he?
But he's always there.
He's not a pure sprinter. He needs it to be a little bit harder, but he's, whether it's a flat sprint or a hilly finish, he's always close. So the margins and the differences in his Ash performance, very, very small. Just returning to De Koning, quick step briefly. The rumours are that Viviani and Richesi are off to Cofidis next year, with Sam Bennett joining De Koning, quick step. And this is what they do. Apparently the offer from Cofidis is very, very generous for Viviani. But we do see sprinters just come and go from De Koning, quick step, and it doesn't seem to matter who they are. They are, you know, you can imagine Sam Bennett picking up where Viviani leaves off. They've got such a well-oiled machine, such a great system there. And Morkov, who, you know, has been a revelation really since he moved to that team, and he's Kristoff's former lead-out man, of course, but he is such a calm head, and he's so adept at handling the bike and the, you know, everything about a sprint finish. A very accomplished track rider, of course.
Yeah, I mean, they're really experienced, aren't they, Richesi and Morkov? Are we saying Morkov or Merku?
Well, he told me last year, Morkov, Michael Morkov. If you're going to say Merku, you also have to use the Danish pronunciation of Michael, which is not Michael, something different. Okay. Anyway,
but between them, they're about 72, aren't they?
Yeah, you know, at least, I mean, 80,
they've got a lot of miles on the clock.
Another Dane at the other end of the age spectrum is Kasper Asgreen. Now, he caught a lot of people's attention at the end of the previous day's stage, because while his teammate won the stage and took the yellow jersey, Asgreen's bike was basically folded in two, snapped in two. He was also quite badly injured and went off to hospital for scans, but he got through today's stage, and it's all the more impressive that Viviani won in a team effectively of seven men. I mean, Asgreen might well have been doing the job that Alaphilippe did. He would certainly have had a role in that lead out at some point. He's a big, strong kind of ruler. But I spoke to Asgreen at the finish. Here's what he said.
The only thing I contributed with today was giving Ilya an extra gel.
Maybe so
that's all the honor I can take. I had the scans and concussion test full checkup yesterday, and everything looked really, really good. I scored really well in the concussion test also, so the doctors had no problems sending me out on the bike today. The only thing is the muscles around the neck is quite sore. They say in a few days that the tension should release, and then I should be back at 100%.
And you coped okay with today's stage, did you?
Yeah, I felt fine on there, and I could take it easy at the back when it was a headwind, and I could go to the front with the team when it was crosswinds, and sit as the last guy sheltered, so it was super nice.
And another stage win for the team, I'm sure that helps as well.
Yeah, super nice. It's incredible, this team. Even being down one teammate, they will still make it work and just win anyway.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
This episode of the Cycling Podcast is sponsored by our friends at beer52.com. If you would like to get a free case of craft beer and pay just £4.95 postage to have that delivered to your door, then go to beer52.com/cycling. That's beer52.com/cycling. Now, this month's case of beers is called the Citizens of Everywhere Beers, and it's a selection from across Europe. It includes the Citra Grisette, which is a collaboration brew from Fine Ales. That's a UK beer. There's Beer Bibliotheque from Sweden. There's the Mango Milkshake IPA by Tiny Rebel in Wales, and from representing France, Mount Salève. So there's something for everyone's tastes. You can get yourself a mixed case if you like darker beers or lighter beers. You can kind of steer the selection in the direction that suits your taste best. And Richard, you get the Beer 52 beers delivered to your house, don't you?
I do, Lionel. Yeah, I haven't had that box yet, actually. So I look forward to receiving that on my return home.
If you would like to get a case of Beer 52 beers, go to beer52.com/cycling. That's beer52.com/cycling. And all you'll pay is the postage charge of £4.95.
Well, we heard from Kasper Asgreen, the young Danish rider, very, very promising rider for De Koninck Quick Step, rode very well at the Tour of Flanders, didn't he? Was he second at the Tour of Flanders? He was second at the Tour of Flanders. But Francois, you were laughing at the Viviani de Cofidis rumours, or rather,
yeah. Well, I was not. Yeah, that's exactly it. I was at the start at the podium, and Viviani came to sign, and we were a couple of journalists talking to him, and he actually, when the suggestion was made that he was signing for Cofidis, he laughed out loud, which doesn't mean he's not going, which means, you know, that it was strange because it
means he's been rumbled.
He was a frank, you know. Laughter, but he seemed to dismiss the idea. But we know very well that, you know, that they're not entitled to say anything before the end of August. So maybe his big laugh meant it's true. That the result of it, true or false, was that, you know, Cofidis have got their own leader, so to speak, Christophe Laporte, who was again, well, nowhere, well, in the top 10. But it's and I saw another thing at the finish, which was a little bit troubling, because we hear there's going to be even more big money in Arkea Samsic next season, and they're probably going to recruit more, you know, new prominent riders. But I saw André Greipel at the end of the stage. Well, obviously, again, he was nowhere to be seen. I mean, there's no such thing as a train with Arkea something, maybe a tram or whatever it is. But in any case, I saw Greipel.
Lead out tram.
Yeah, that's what it was. Let's face it. And I saw Greipel going into the bus, and the Arkea something technicians were there mending his bike, and this mechanic was looking at Greipel trying to fix something. I couldn't tell what it was. And Greipel looked at him and said, okay, forget it. You know, there might have been a problem.
The rider mechanic dynamic is a very awkward one.
I know.
And you wouldn't want to be a mechanic on a team struggling for wins, or with a rider who's having a bad time. You're going to be the first to get it in the neck, aren't you?
I just can't get the Arkea Samsic lead out tram. Imagine a bell clanging, trundling along,
just going. It can't move left or right. It's just stuck.
Just falling out the back of the bunch,
leading their man out to 175th. but just on the Viviani to Cofidis rumour story, I mean, we should credit our very good friend Ciro Scognamiglio, never knowingly incorrect about these things.
That's probably
that
right,
apart from when he is.
From La Gazzetta dello Sport. But just to kind of plug an earlier episode for Friends of the Podcast, listening to Patrick Lefevre, the boss of De Koninck Quickstep, talk about how rigid the wage structure is at De Koninck Quickstep. He will not bust that wage structure for anyone, whether it's someone he considered almost as a son, Nicky Terpstra, or Fernando Gaviria, who is, you know, one of the greatest, brightest talents in sprinting. He will decide his price, and he won't pay a euro more than what he considers to be the fair price. And so That in one way makes him vulnerable to having riders picked off, but it also means that he has a sort of certain confidence that he can just, okay, Viviani goes and maybe Sam Bennett comes in if this is what, if the rumours are true, you know,
Gilbert is going as well.
Because,
you know, he was apparently angry and not being picked for the tour, and so going somewhere.
And offered 1 year rather than three or whatever. And so, I mean, Lefebvre is a proper businessman manager, isn't he? And I'm not saying that other people aren't, but it's one of the more obvious examples of someone who is building his team according to his budget and trying to make sure he gets the most bang for his buck.
Well, today was a perfect day for that team to come in quick set, because defending the jersey and setting up the sprint for Viviani involved doing exactly the same thing, and they did it very well. I spoke to Geert Van Bont at the start, one of their DSs, and he talked about that and about Alaphilippe having to curb his attacking instincts with being in the yellow jersey. He said tomorrow's stage would have really suited Alaphilippe. He fancied having a go. He's not going to be able to do that, of course. But today was the first day out of yellow for Mike Tunison, who's had the jersey since the start. And you spoke to him this morning, Lionel. Shall we hear from him now?
Mike Tunison's been the man for a couple of days on the tour, surrounded by journalists. And this morning I just kind of caught him as he was coming back from sign-on. More than happy to chat.
Funny enough, their bus was beside the Dukernan Quick-Step bus, wasn't it?
It was, yeah.
And when you're speaking to him, you can hear the cheer is for Alaphilippe.
Yeah.
And I thought that was just fascinating.
Absolutely,
juxtaposition.
Yeah. How quickly the adoration,
the story
kind of
moves on.
The halo moves from one bus to the other. So this is Mike Tunison, the former yellow jersey.
Well, Mike, still in yellow, but not quite the maillot jaune.
No, it's a nice jersey, but the other one was quite a lot nicer. There were two amazing days. And then, like I said yesterday already, now it's back to reality. Yeah?
But better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all. You couldn't have expected that coming into the race.
Exactly. And it was still a small disappointment yesterday that it slipped away, but those 2 days, they will never take away from me. Yeah? And probably at the end of my career and even longer, they will remember me and I will remember it. And it's something special. It's great.
What went through your mind on Saturday when obviously you knew Dylan had crashed, you'd got through, and then the possibility is there? What were you thinking?
Yeah, actually, the first thing I thought was we worked so hard for it. It's such a shame that we lost it now. And then I felt good, and I just tried to get some result out of it, that all the work was at least not for nothing. And then I thought I'd just try and see whatever happens. But yeah, of course, I never imagined also in that final K that I would actually win the stage. So in the end, I'm pretty happy I went for it, because the turnout was pretty amazing. But I never expected it.
And then the team time trial, 20 seconds in 27 kilometres is an impressive result in any race. But with the teams behind you, what we know a little bit about how much work has gone into improving, that element of the team's performance. But how did it feel for it all to come together on the day?
Yeah, it was a big goal for us. And of course, then you think of the win and you go for the win. But actually to pull it off, and then also with that difference, that amount of seconds we gained on the others, was even more special. And I think it's just a big thumbs up from everyone in the team who worked for it. Like you said, there is a lot of work that went into the preparations of this day. And great to see it result in that win and that margin. It was another amazing day, and I think after 2 days our tour was already so well that whatever comes next is bonus. And today is another big opportunity, and spirit is good, morale is high, so yeah, we go for it again.
What was it like when you were losing contact yesterday? Obviously a beautiful part of France and all the champagne vineyards around you, but did you get an appreciation of just how hard the tour can be at the front when everyone is putting the pressure on?
The first hours were amazing, and then afterwards, already on that first climb where the pace went higher, I felt that it was not my day. Legs were not there anymore. I think that the past 2 days were emotionally but also physically quite hard. And that I felt already in the race, and there I also said to the guys, go ahead, don't look back for me because I probably will not make it. And that's pretty harsh, but that's also cycling, and I try to hang on as long as possible, but you know it's going to be even harder on the final climb. So yeah, I already saw it coming, but still was a big shame, of course, to let the group go and to lose.
I saw you flip your elbow at the Cofidis rider, Julien Simon, who was in your wheel, hoping that he might come through and give you a turn, but he didn't move for quite a while.
Yeah, actually, yeah, he dropped also, and I think he was pretty tired. But actually, afterwards, he helped me quite well, while it was actually not necessary. So, yeah, we didn't make it. You know, already it's actually quite possibly not possible anymore. But still, I appreciated the gesture afterwards and to thank him. And unfortunately, it was for nothing.
I think that the problem with Tunisian, and I mean the Jumbo-Visma sprint today, is that they're probably, unlike the Deceuninck Quick-Step train, they're probably struggling for positions. How do you organize a train with a guy who won the stage one, held the yellow jersey, Dylan Groenewegen, who... Well, it's normally the sprinter, but he's injured, and Wout van Aert, who is the yellow, the white jersey, and could actually go for, you know, if he takes a little bit of bonus, go for the yellow. So I don't know how they organize this train, but obviously it didn't work that well, because when you've got a guy, Groenewegen fifth, and his lead out man, Tunisian in sixth, that's probably your problem somewhere.
Well, that's the old Sean Kelly cardinal sin theory, which is that if you've got two sprinters who finish, you know, fifth and sixth or fourth and fifth, the team will be getting a rollicking round the dinner table for basically not prioritising one or the other. But I don't think that was the case with Jumbo-Visma today. I think, you know, Groenewegen, we don't know the extent of his injuries, but he took a pretty hefty bashing on day one. Tunisian is obviously flying. I mean, not just in this tour, but, you know, the results that go back 6 weeks or so. I think that when we saw Alaphilippe do a turn for Viviani, the really progressive teams are the ones where the today's star can turn his hand to doing something for another member of the team. And I think we see that with Deceuninck Quick-Step quite frequently. You know, Jumbo-Visma don't strike me as a team riven by kind of, you know, conflicts. I mean, we saw Steven Kruiswijk really absolutely over the moon when Tunisian won on stage one, you know, sharing in that.
I'm not speaking of conflict. I'm speaking of probably disorganization.
Organization, yeah, okay. But I guess that comes down to a certain confidence that, well, this is what we're doing today, and if the voice on the radio is, this is what we're doing today, this is what we're doing. Or if everyone respects Morkov, Merku, when he says, right, yet Mayo Jaune, you're now doing a turn, and Alaphilippe does that turn. I mean, that says a lot for the team's culture, the team's kind of cohesion, and the fact that, you know, it's eight guys all trying to get the best possible result out of the Tour de France. Just to go back to Geert Van Bont before we move on, I need to catch up with him and ask him about his fascination/obsession with the full English breakfast. He used to, in his past days with other teams, where he would always put his hand up and volunteer for the Tour of Britain on the basis that he could have a week's worth of full English breakfast in British hotels. And he loves black pudding and a sausage and bacon, and a man after my own heart.
Can I have a quick one back on Alaphilippe leading the train? There was a kind of a reminiscence of Bradley Wiggins leading out with a yellow jersey on his back, and it's not a random comparison, because Alaphilippe talked about it today. He was asked if he was an old school rider, and he actually didn't say no. Obviously, Alaphilippe is very aware of his image. He knows he probably will never win a Grand Tour, but you know what makes him stand out from the others is you know, his aggressive style, is kind of a swashbuckling fashion, even, you know, his little beard now, and he said he was, you know, he was interested in the history of cycling, he was interested in, you know, leaving a mark in the history of cycling, and he said he would like to leave a mark for his style. And so being in the yellow jersey leading out a sprint for a teammate is part of, you know, I think brick by brick is trying to build this image of, you know, Alaphilippe, the panache rider.
The cycling podcast at the 2019 Tour de France is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science and Sport for supporting the Cycling Podcast. You can get 25% off all your Science and Sport products at scienceandsport.com with the code Lionel.
SISCP25. I've gone for a robotic rendition.
That sounds like some of the calls I've been getting asking me about
PPI.
Life insurance and things like PPI, yeah. Anyway, thank you to Science and Sport for their support. Very, very grateful to them. Now, Francois, you spoke at the finish to friend of the podcast, Ioan Alfredo. Ioan Alfredo, of course, a former winner of Pedlar de Charme. We are looking for nominations for Pedlar de Charme. Please email us, contact@thecyclingpodcast.com, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Give us your nominations.
Alfredo's already been nominated for his fist bumps with his breakaway companions yesterday when they were getting caught.
He's a cool cat.
Yeah,
Let's hear a little bit from Alfredo at the finish.
So, Ioan, again in the front. What was the chance today?
Zero. Five. Sometimes you don't need a plan, and it was not my plan today to go in the front, but my way of life is to don't feel the rules, and that's why I prefer to stay in front. And I think in the bench with a stage like this one is a little bit boring. That's why I want to be in front. And okay, I win nothing, no prize, nothing, but when you receive a lot of applause, a lot of everything, it's very, a very good thing for me, because 2 months ago it was not possible for me to use my arm, my legs, and so I'm very happy to be here, and especially in front of the biggest race of the world.
In your first Tour de France, you suffered a lot. You even, we saw you crying, but you seem to enjoy it more and more, this race.
Yeah, for sure. 2 years ago, it was my first Tour de France. It was hard because I was sick, but when I crossed the line in Paris, I was very, very happy. And last year, I was a little bit, not disappointed, but...
Not blasé, but...
Not blasé, but it was, for my head, it was, oh, what a shame. Maybe it was possible to do something more, and that's why I try to attack now, or when I can, when I want, and... when I feel it.
Is there a little competition within the team with Frederick Backert? Because you seem to be in the front each day, either you or either him.
No, it's not a competition. We have to do our job, and we do it.
Yeah, the funny thing about the little gestures they made yesterday in the stage, between the breakaway, is actually they have a little group of riders, Alfredo and Rossetto. They train together. They know each other well. They've known each other for a long time, and they have a kind of little competition between them, saying, okay, who is going to be on the break? You know, these are the kind of riders that are good riders. They know they can, you know, they can attack. They don't like to stay in the bunch, like Alfredo said himself. And so there was a kind of a little gamble. Are you going to be in the break today or me? And they found themselves, you know, two of them in the break. There are a bunch of four or five riders doing that. And when they found themselves in the break, say, well, that's great. You know, here we are. And that's why, you know, the little... punching at the end of the yesterday's break was due to that. You know, they've got that little group of...
Well, Ioan Alfredo, probably another contender. I mean, nobody's worn the Pedlar de Charme t-shirt better than Ioan Alfredo.
He's got an amazingly angular haircut.
Great hair.
It's incredible.
Which is one of the criteria, of course. That's no disrespect to Adam, friend of the podcast, who was at the start this morning. Adam, in your Pedlar de Charme t-shirt, came and said hello. Always nice to meet listeners to the podcast. And... yeah, keep your nominations coming in for Pedlar de Charme. Well, a team that's been pretty prominent at the front of the last couple of days has been Team Ineos. And you speak to a lot of DSs from other teams, and they look at Ineos as the favourites for the race, whether it be Geraint Thomas or Egan Bernal. I spoke to their road captain, Luke Rowe, at the finish tonight, just about what his impressions were, in particular of Egan Bernal, who has joint leader status here at the Tour, along with Thomas. So here's what Luke Rowe said a few days into this year's Tour. You're going with joint leaders, obviously. How well do you know Bernal, and how impressive is he as a joint leader for such a young rider?
I don't know how much you see and how much you can see in the position of our team, but you see, you know, G will sit quite far forward, a couple of wheels back, and then Egan is directly on G's wheel. And to stay on one wheel and go through the peloton and through the carnage and manage to stay on that wheel, it's a hard thing to do. And he makes it look like a piece of piss, you know, like he's done it for 10 years. So, you know, that way we can look after them both. If Bernal's always on G's wheel and G's always safe, then, you know, two birds with one stone, and he's doing a bloody good job. Kind of staying on that train and staying safe. Old beyond his, what's the years? What's the saying?
Old beyond his years.
We'll have that one, yeah.
It's always chaotic and dangerous at the start of the tour. How the first few days been here?
Not as bad. I don't know why, but it just seems a bit less chaotic. That being said, yeah, the last 50k in the finals are tough and tricky, and, you know, we've seen more crashes again today. But in general, it's been really good. There's been a good level of respect amongst everyone, which is nice to see. And I think, in general, I think it has been safer, yeah.
So that was Luke Rowe. Obviously, Bernal 5 seconds ahead now of Geraint Thomas after the little split on Monday. And I think you overheard him speaking this morning, Francois.
Yeah, he was at the podium talking to, well, us, you know, journalists. And of course, the question was asked, well, you know, what happened? How did you lose 5 seconds to Bernal? And he said, yeah, well, obviously something went wrong, you know, there. But, you know what Thomas is like. He was very philosophical about it, saying, well, you know, 5 seconds is not more. It's a long road. But, yeah, but apparently no grudge whatsoever or no. But he said there was obviously something dysfunctional a little bit. But, you know, the way Geraint Thomas would say it, without the, you know, kind of motionless face and with a little hint of humor behind that. So, yeah. I mean, we're making stories out of nothing, don't we?
Well, we are at the moment. I mean, Bernal tried.
Sorry,
to
job,
kind of,
Francois.
He was pretty sprightly where around the time that Alaphilippe went away, wasn't he? And
but according to our friend of the podcast, Adam, who we met at the start, he'd overheard Dave Brailsford saying that Bernal had actually tried to go with Alaphilippe and didn't have the legs to go with him. It wouldn't have lasted very long had he gone with him. But that was interesting. I mean, it was a finished, you know, climb tailor-made for Alaphilippe, so maybe shouldn't read too much into that. But we're looking ahead to La Planche des Belles Filles. But before that, Lionel, we're looking ahead to outside the team buses with the feature. And a very, very sort of prescient pick today, Jasper Philipsen, the young Belgian rider on UAE Team Emirates. And, he played a very prominent role in the finish. He did a fantastic job for Christophe. For about 2 kilometres, he was really, you know, you could pick him out, and he was working hard, and he dropped Christophe off perfectly. In fact, Christophe was full of praise for him at the finish. Let's hear first briefly from Christophe.
Hold us in a really nice spot, and at 400 metres, I think he started 450 in the last left bend. Maybe I jumped a little bit too early from his wheel into the behind Quickstep. Maybe I could have waited a little bit longer because he had still a good speed. So, what is the first time they actually do lead out was the first time in the first stage. So, I don't really know how strong he is in the final. So, today he surprised me very positively. He did a really good job. And to be 21 years and deliver me like that, it was impressive.
Just before we heard from Christophe, that was Daniel Freeb going past on his skateboard. No, it wasn't really. It was just a young French boy going past on a skateboard. Outside the team bus, this was kind of a second bite at the cherry with Jasper Philipsen because, I was rebuffed by UAE Team Emirates yesterday. But today I spoke to Philipsen, the youngest rider in the race, only 21 years of age, first year professional, well, certainly first year in the World Tour. He rode for the Hagens Berman Axion team last year, and he won a stage of the Tour Down Under in January to announce his arrival on the World Tour stage, but surely couldn't have expected to be lining up for not just a Grand Tour in his first year, but the Tour de France. So I was keen to just find out how he was bedding in.
Outside the team bus, with
Jasper Philipsen, UAE Team Emirates.
Jasper, you had a bit of a crash towards the end of yesterday's stage, I think. What happened and how are you this morning?
It was a bit of a stupid crash. We already checked out after this climb, and we were taking it easy to the finish line, but then there was a roundabout, and this corner was a little bit turning further than I expected, and my wheel just slipped away, so a stupid crash, but luckily I didn't have any bad injuries.
It's your first year as a pro, your first Grand Tour, your first Tour de France. You're the youngest guy in the race. Do you notice the differences in the racing style between what you're used to?
In the youth categories, it's always racing from start to finish line, and in the pro categories, it's more controlled, and you can kind of expect how the race will evolve. But it's a really, really hard final, and during the day, it's maybe more easy than the youth categories.
Were you expecting at the start of the year that you would get to ride the Tour in your first year?
No, it was a last-minute decision, but I'm really happy and I'm proud to be here. It's a big honor for me that the team gave me this opportunity to start in this Tour de France.
What's the longest stage race you've done before?
The Giro U23 of 10 days, 10-11 days. So, yeah, we'll see. This is probably double.
Is there any pressure on you to go as far as you can? They're not going to be disappointed if you get maybe the second week and decide that's enough for your young legs?
No, the team don't put any pressure on me. If we feel it's necessary to go out, or then they will just send me home. So that's not a big problem. I'm here to try to gain as much experience as I can and to help Alex in the final sprints. We take it day by day, and then the team will decide how my race will evolve.
How much have you ridden with Alexander Christophe before this race?
Yeah, we did the classics together, so we know a bit of the riding styles. Never was in this position to really lead him out, so that's new for us. And yeah, the first day we were there in good position, but then I touched somebody, went in the barriers and almost crashed. So that was a little bit mistake. It's hard to say it was a mistake. We just tried to do this better and then learn from this. It was the first time, but I'm sure we can do a good job today.
What did you think of the Grand Départ in Brussels? And obviously everything was about Eddy Merckx, and of course you know Eddy's son Axel because you rode on Axel's team. Did you see Axel at all over the weekend?
Yeah, I saw Axel when we did a recon, so it was nice to see him.
He must have been very proud that you're already here in the Tour de France. He played a role in getting you here, I guess.
Yeah, he has a lot of young riders in his team who managed to get to the pro ranks, and he's doing just a great job with his team. Really nice team, and had some good memories there. So for sure, he's proud on every ex-team member.
And lastly, you were born in Mol, the same town as Tom Bonen.
Yes.
When you were growing up, what kind of profile did Tom Bonen have? And was he one of your first idols when you were getting interested in cycling?
Oh, for sure, he was the big star when I was younger. So for sure, it played also a bigger role why I started cycling and why I started to like it.
Have you ever met him?
Yes, well, he's a nice guy.
Can he give you any tips about sprinting in the Tour, maybe?
Yeah, he gave me already some tips, but yeah, I still have to do it myself.
Well, good luck today.
Thank you.
Well, that's Jasper Philipsen, and outside the team bus has survived 4 days of the Tour. Just how many? 17 to go. It's going to be like a real scrambling game of musical chairs by the end, isn't it? I mean, will there even be any English speakers left in the last few teams? That's the drama of it. What if I'd set myself this challenge? But we shall see, won't we? Tomorrow I'll be outside another team bus with somebody.
And we should mention last night what an extraordinary experience we had, thanks to David Hesketh, a friend of the podcast, who very kindly, he's a managing director in the UK for Laurent Perrier Champagne, and he treated us to an experience that we won't top at this Tour, and we won't forget either.
Even Francois said we had a glimpse behind the doors of the fine champagne houses that even the French wouldn't necessarily have.
Yeah, I don't think there's an industry because it is in an industry, even if it presents itself differently, that bears hold so much secrecy as winemaking. And we were really introduced into behind the scenes. I mean, we in that castle with the woman who's been working for Laurent Perrier forever, and we take, well, let's speak the truth, you know, as we said before, we the French don't disguise anything. We had 7 or 8 different kinds of champagne from Laurent Perrier, some of the best vintages they ever made. It was at the right temperature with a maître d'eau in full gear, you know, with the white gloves and everything. It was absolutely amazing. The discussion around wines and the qualities of the bubbles and the tannins and the acidity and everything was absolutely amazing. We were in the heart, you know, in the hardcore of the champagne making. It was really exciting, very interesting as such. And I just wanted to point out to some of you listeners who think that we might be talking a little bit too much about wine, food, whatever, that if you believe the Tour de France to be a bike race, you're wrong. You know, the Tour de France is much more than this. The Tour de France is about traveling around France. It's about the monuments, about the mountains, and about the way of life. The Tour de France is not a bike race. It's a lifestyle. And if you don't understand that, you should listen to another podcast.
Punchy stuff from François. And a hand gesture to go with it. But the tour is a marketing exercise for France, and it's why Brussels or any other country that hosts the Grand Depart wants to do so, because they know they're going to get eyeballs and exposure and showcase their region to a lot of people. And there must be people who watch the Tour de France on TV, not just in Britain but elsewhere, who think, I'm going to go there on holiday. And I mean, certainly, you know, the Champagne region is somewhere that I wouldn't necessarily have thought, I'll go there on holiday, but learning a little bit more about the region and the winemaking.
And it was fascinating. Yeah. I mean, that specificity of the region and the connection with Champagne, it's a bit like Scotland and whiskey. And I was speaking to David about whiskey. My palate's quite well adapted to the different flavors of whiskey, and last night was a revelation to me in the range of flavors in the different champagnes. But also we had a chat with him about, you know, climate change and how that's affecting champagne and the grapes and so on, and how, you know, some of the sparkling wines now being produced in the south of England are rivaling champagne for taste and quality. And so it was a really interesting, an educational experience. And that, yeah, you're right, Francois, that's a great privilege of covering the tour, isn't it? Experiencing all that. So,
and I think we'll play an extended kind of champagne section in our road trip episode for Friends of the Podcast.
Speaking of Friends of the Podcast, just before we wrap up for tonight, we should say thanks to some of the people who have signed up as Friends of the Podcast, which you can do at thecyclingpodcast.com. We are recording as we go around for another road trip episode, which we did a couple of years ago. And bizarrely, we're doing it again. But thank you to James Veal, Christopher Matheson, Scott Robson, David Guild, and Stephen Gardner.
Thank you to Rob Starrick, Roger Clotworthy, Stephen Pond, Tristan Price, Thomas Bridges.
And thank you to Oliver Green, Richard Charles, Julian Isles, Mark Cox, and Danielle Alessia. I hope that's correct.
Thank you, everyone who signed up as a friend of the podcast at cyclingpodcast.com. You helped to support us. Another shout out for our show at the World Championships in Harrogate. You'll find ticket details at thecyclingpodcast.com. And also a reminder that you can win an Austin Cycles folding bike, carbon fibre folding bike worth £2,750. If you sign up to our newsletter, or if you're already signed up to our newsletter, when you get the newsletter, there'll be a link to the Austin Cycles website where you can leave your name and the reason why you should win the folding bike that we are using here.
I must say, I spent the day sitting next to the bike in the car, and it's worth really, you know,
it's worth winning.
So go for it.
And a very last mention for Kilometre Zero, our series which goes out every weekday morning, 2 episodes in. The first was on Eddie Merckx, the greatest of all time. And today's one was on a set of leaders' jerseys from the 1989 tour, designed by the Italian pop artist, kind of the Italian Andy Warhol, Mario Schifano. A small obsession of mine, these jerseys.
Is that a pronunciation, please? I think your pronunciation there was fine, Lionel.
Yeah, I think it was. Yeah, Huey Morgan from the Fun Loving Criminals got it wrong on BBC Radio 6 Music when he gave us a name check at the weekend. Episode 3 of Kilometre Zero will be out tomorrow. You have to wait to find out what that is. We've been beavering away.
Can we not say what that is?
Well, if you, yeah,
it's an extended conversation with Fran Miller, the chief executive at Team Ineos, recently promoted to chief executive. So it's a chat with her, which hopefully people will find interesting.
Yeah, all Kilometre Zero episodes are available on our free-to-air feed. Thanks almost entirely to the sponsorship and support of Hansgrohe Showers and Taps. So big thank you to them. But yeah, you can just find those. You don't need to be a friend of the podcast to listen to Kilometre Zero. It should just drop into your feed along with the regular episodes.
Right, let's go for dinner. Straight across the square there to the fancy restaurant. Thank you very much, Lionel.
Do they do the largest quiche in the world in there?
Well, we'll find out.
I'm afraid not, but they might do the largest bill in the world, so...
Oh, crap.
No, sorry, guys. Oh, okay.
Thanks again to the friends of the podcast.
You have been listening to the Cycling Podcast at the 2018 Tour de France. Thanks to our sponsors, Tafa and Science in Sport. The music is by Santoré. This episode was produced by John Mooney.